We're talking about tethered drones as a fix for the rural broadband issue in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, glad you could be here. The firm Wisconsin Telelift is deploying these tethered drone platforms equipped with cell phone towers as part of a six-month pilot project with the Northland Pine School District in Eagle River. Do you see drones as part of the solution for rural broadband? Do you live in the North Woods or a wooded area where the internet is spotty at best? What is that like for you? 800-642-1234. Scott Williams is founder of Wisconsin Telelift, a startup working to provide high-speed internet using drone-powered cell towers. Scott, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, this district is hundreds of square miles, more than 1,300 students. What does it take to get them internet access in this type of topography?
Well, it's really challenging. Some of the things we see in the Northwoods, you know, trees and water are really hard on radio signals. And so it's difficult no matter what. And with the population being as thin as it is, it's not like we can run fiber to every single person's house. So it's always trying to come up with new and creative ways to get that last mile.
Enter the drone. What are you doing?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting project. You know, when the pandemic hit, we'd been working on this project for several years, but it's really designed for emergency management and military use. And we were sitting talking with a lot of different people at the state, and education was at the top of everyone's mind. How do we solve what's going on? And we said, well, we can definitely give it a try. So we're lifting up different radios and trying to figure out the best way to make sure we can get students connected safely at home.
Okay, so you're lifting up into the air this communications equipment. Can you give us a bird's eye view, if you will? What does it look like? How big is it? Help us see it in our mind's eye.
Yeah, absolutely. So the aircraft itself it's about the size of a square kitchen table. It's about 5x5 with the rotors expanded out. It's got a really small 18 gauge cable that comes down, and we power it from the ground using 220 volt AC, much like you would power a dryer. We have both generators that we can use, or we can plug it into like the building. And then as far as it goes from there, then we're trying different radios inside of it. So right now we're playing with a 4G system, much like Verizon, if you were getting on your phone, but we'll also be pushing out Wi-Fi as well.
Okay, so how long can it stay in the air?
Great question. Our aircraft's a lot different than other people's out there. It was designed to do this. We've flown it for more than 42 days. And then we had a blizzard set in over in Minneapolis. We were actually flying inside of a shed, and the shed started to collapse, so we shut it down. So it can fly for extremely long periods of time. But when you think about schools and the challenge we have there, what we really want to do is kind of set an academic call to quarters period. So, you know, putting it up in the morning, flying it to a certain point, and then we know we want our students and staff to get rest, so we actually land it and we can go use it for other things.
Okay, so you kind of see more of an up-down, you know, on-the-clock, off-the-clock offering here.
That's right. So we like to talk about dynamic networks, and really what we're talking about there is putting connectivity when and where it's needed. So, you know, during the day when people are at work or at school, you might want the system there. And then in the evening, you might want to transmit a county board meeting, for instance. And then in the evening time, you might simply be, you know, checking it out, making sure it's good and using it if there's any kind of an emergency, a wildfire or a hurricane. And then you kind of start over the next day. And it's all about prioritizing and sharing the resource.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Scott Williams, founder of Wisconsin Telelift. It's working to provide high-speed internet access using these drone-powered cell towers. And his grant with Forest County is a pilot project to provide access to students in the North Woods. You can join in on connectivity where you are. What questions do you have about these drones and this technology? 800-642-1234. Scott, we heard from Jim and Beaver Dam, called in, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to know, why use drones instead of something similar to, say, a weather balloon? It could be cheaper and better for the environment.
Yeah, actually, for both of those reasons, we wouldn't want to use that. So balloons have been tried. There's been lots of different efforts. A lot of people have followed the Google Loon project, which is a large thing, almost like a blimp. And they're really expensive to operate. And so this is a much simpler design, a lower cost, and much more effective in transporting it around. Originally, we thought we were replacing things like cellular towers on wheels or permanent infrastructure, but we really have our own niche. We're much smaller and quicker to deploy, so it makes a lot of sense.
Do you see this as a temporary solution, or do you find this as more of a long-term fix in order to get high-speed internet to these homes in the North Woods?
Sure. It's a persistent temporary network is what we call it, meaning it can go out there for weeks at a time. We're not here to replace permanent infrastructure. What you can do with a good fiber connection is really great. But we do think it is a permanent solution, the idea of dynamic networking and moving it around. So we think it's here to stay. You know, the school is a very challenging and different program, and there's things you have to keep in mind. So right now we're really trying to solve how we send out a virtual private network and keep our students safe at home. The challenge with it is you can't just give students internet at home, regular broadband if they can't afford it, because, you know, then they could be threatened or endangered, and we don't want to do that. And there are students who just don't have access because of where they live. So you kind of have to take on the low income side and the people who don't have availability. And so what we're solving right now is how do we put the school's network, firewall and everything intact, so the students can only see the sites they would see at school and connect the same way if they were at home. And that's a really neat challenge. And the lessons we learn from that will last for generations.
So how is it going? You started this testing about in February. Where are you at?
Well, we're pretty excited. We actually flew last week on generator power. We'll be flying this week off of power at a concession stand at the school. It's going well. We had two students actually operate it. You know, part of the program is that we're excited about when we talk about the school is this is the next generation. This is them learning and being involved. And so we have interns learning about the system, working on the system, doing the networking. And I think we're making great progress, and hopefully we get a solution that really helps out students in the future.
Do you have to navigate any restrictions through the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, on these drones? They're huge.
We absolutely do. So we keep it under 55 pounds, which is what they consider a small UAV, but we follow all of the rules. So there are challenges involved that at this stage we have to sit and watch and operate it. I have a commercial license and I'm able to oversee others flying, but we need commercial pilots flying it. We want to do everything correctly. And it's very interesting. Eagle River Airport is right next to the Northland Pines School District. So we have to communicate with the airport and make sure we're staying out of their way and doing all of the things that the FAA has set in place. And that's something we really want to teach. We're actually working on different syllabuses and training and education for schools to make sure that schools start operating correctly, because drone usage is not always following the rules the FAA has out there. And we want to make sure that people are always following those.
We're talking with Scott Williams, founder of Telelift, a company developing and manufacturing flying cell tower technology. Are you in Eagle River or a student in the North Woods? What are your thoughts on this pilot program to make high-speed internet a reality with tethered drones? Join in your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Scott Williams here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about tethered drone technology, lifting communication equipment into the air and creating a tower for cell phone and internet connectivity. Governor Evers announced in February that the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation would provide a $100,000 grant in Forest County for a pilot program to test the drone-based system. Do you think drones are part of the solution for rural broadband? What do you want to know about using this technology? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Telelift founder Scott Williams, who's with us for 10 more minutes. Scott, you know, looking more broadly here, Google closed its internet drone project Titan in 2016, citing technical difficulties, funding issues. Facebook halted its internet drone program in 2018. What does it mean for these tech giants to abandon these projects and this technology?
Yeah, it's a really difficult challenge, and it actually shows just how far we've come. We knew going in that drones were not going to solve everything. And I kind of was an anti-drone person. I was a pilot for the Air Force, and we were tired of hearing people saying, hey, we have this drone and it can do everything. And what we realized is you have to focus on the actual issue at hand and then build a solution accordingly. So a lot of times people will take a drone and then they'll try to do a whole bunch of things with it. And what we did is we designed it from there. You know, we designed it going, this is the challenge and how do we make it? So we built it from the ground up, and we're very different than our competitors, and we've had great success because of that.
When you say you're very different from your competitors, how so? What is this marketplace like?
Yeah, sure. When we started this, we were doing research, doing anti-poaching, fighting organized crime in Africa, and we kept seeing these challenges. And along the way, we had a young student from Purdue contact us, and like a lot of younger people, he wanted to save the world with his invention, and he was really good at drones. So we gave him our design, where we were at, and he built it into something different. And we say all the time, we welcome the youth. You know, a lot of people and make the jokes about younger generations. And we think they're the ones who are going to save our environment and save our planet. So we empowered this young man, and he built the company, and they're the manufacturer of the drone. And they built it to a size and a shape that I never could have imagined. And then they came back to us and said, we have it. Now we have to figure out how to get it to market. And that's where I came back in, actually left my job to do full time. And the design and the way we've built it to actually serve this actual piece is what's making us successful. And that's exciting.
Well, let's bring in Terry now in St. Germain with a question. Hi, Terry, go ahead.
Good morning. Hi, this is very interesting. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, go ahead, Terry. We hear you.
The question I had was, did I understand that there is a power line that is tethered to the ground to the drone?
That's correct, Terry. So we plug into a 220 volt AC either to a building or a generator, and then we push over 400 volts up a small line. So it's actually connected to the ground.
So the power line is an actual live line. You know, this is a time of you know, a lot of fire issues, and I guess that would always concern me of something becoming detached or something that could cause a problem with the fire in rural areas.
Yeah, it's not any different than anything that you use electricity for. So if you think about plugging in a tool or realize that a cellular tower uses electricity, right? So obviously, if you want to transmit radio waves, you've got to use some sort of power. We've got a lot of safety features in place, and it's simply a 30-amp circuit breaker that you would have on your house.
Terry, thank you for the call. We have a couple questions, people wanting to pick your brain about SpaceX, Elon Musk's SpaceX rolling out Starlink, a satellite internet program to the public 6 months ago. Saul wants to know about it in terms of, is this a solution for the future? Robert in Milwaukee asking the same question.
Well, I can give you my opinion, which is any movement towards getting people connected is a positive thing. And I can tell you that I'm on the waiting list up here in the Northwoods. I've already put my money down. We want to play with it and see how it works. is it the solution? I really caution there's no such thing as the solution. When you look at it, I used the analogy of an onion earlier. There's all these layers. And in order to solve the global problems that we have, you got to take really small slices of that. And so we're excited that satellite internet and the new generation of satellite internet, because satellite internet's been around for a long time, is going to be an important layer or two of the overall solution. And we're certainly here to encourage others to try things like Starlink.
What is your internet like at home in Three Lakes near the Michigan border?
Well, knock on wood, right now it's pretty good right where I'm at. Now we have neighbors on each side of us who don't have it. And you can imagine in the business that we're in that we spend a pretty good amount trying to make sure we have that, you know, and one of the things that we like to talk about is it's not just internet that we have challenges up here. You know, Forest County has almost 40% of the county doesn't have radio connectivity for our first responders and emergency people, and that includes cell phones. So the neat part of the drone is that putting a connection up there saves lives.
Talking with Scott Williams, founder of Wisconsin Telelift, working to provide high-speed internet access using drone-powered cell towers. Taking your questions about it, 800-642-1234. Sean is joining us in Fond du Lac. Hi, Sean.
Hi, good morning. Great topic, and hopefully we can finally get something done here. So I live 3 miles away from a larger city, just outside of Fond du Lac. And I have basically two options for internet, and I'm going to do air quotes in the air for high speed. One is a wire, but I'm like at the end of the wire, so there's not much water in the hose anymore, I guess. Or radio to radio, you know, hitting a water tower that's like out of my range, and I can max out at about 15 meg download, one up. So I am a at-home virtual teacher, full-time, doing it before it was popular, and I pay buku dollars. My question is, why couldn't, the power company puts a meter on your house. Why couldn't all houses be peer-to-peer repeaters?
Sean, thank you for that. Getting a bit technical there, Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of choices. We've actually done peer-to-peer work in Africa, and I think you're going down the right path. And, you know, there's a big argument of, should this be a utility? Is it the seventh utility, for instance? And I'm a big proponent of that, but I don't get a say in that determination. There are some things that can be done, and part of what we're trying to do with the school, and I appreciate our teachers talking about some of the challenges they have at home, is to get that connection for free to our people. So that's the idea for sure.
Question, why not install cell towers on trees or other tall objects in the landscape to expand access?
Well, trees would make it very difficult, right? Because leaves and movement, and you got to remember, again, you have to have power going there. So we've already had people with concerns of that. So there are some options to connect different things to different places, and a lot of neat technology coming along. We hear a lot of talk about 5G in this area, but it doesn't make sense for the cell phone companies to spend money when they don't have enough people paying for upticks, or we're trying to make different solutions. And hopefully when we get into sixth generation radios, we're going to see some very big changes. We know some of the prototype equipment we're working with can cover really large distances, and that could be a game changer.
Well, speaking of prototypes and looking ahead into the future, Pete emailed to wonder about the future of this technology. Could you envision, you know, a future where a fleet of driverless cars could serve as hubs to deliver broadband to underserved areas?
Well, not only can I envision it, but it's really about what the next generation can envision, because I know they have much better solutions and concepts than I do. So we're in this for the long haul at Wisklift. This is about getting kids literally doing things like soldering wires together and thinking about technology, because as our listeners here come up with thousands of ideas, I've had thousands of my own, but it's that next generation that's really going to make the change.
All right. Well, circling back to Forest County, what is the next stage of your grant process here? It's a 6-month project. What comes next?
Yeah, so the grant funding was actually to do a capacity study. And what we're looking at is all of the parts and pieces that can be built locally. Can we upfit these into trailers, which we know we can, and can we build those in Forest County? Can we put them on our friends over at Hometown Trolley on one of their buses and make a mobile command center? So the funding wasn't actually for the school. That was all privately funded by someone who said, I want to make sure kids get internet and we're going to do this. So where we're at with the grant is figuring out how much of it can be made here. How many jobs can we get? We already know that all telelift training is going to be done in Forest County, and we've identified a 500-acre farm where usage has been donated, and we're trying to stand it up to see how much of the parts can be manufactured with everyone in the ecosystem building parts and doing a final assembly there at the farm. That's the next step.
Scott, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Scott Williams is founder of Wisconsin Telelift. Coming up, we talk with a parent who is fighting racism in the Burlington Area School District. Has your child experienced racism at school? Did you or the student report the incident? What was the outcome? It's 800-642-1234. We'll talk about it after a news update on the Ideas Network. Now, the Burlington Area School District has until May 9th to submit a corrective action plan to the Department of Public Instruction. It must remedy a racially hostile environment following an investigation of at least 19 incidents of racial harassment in district records spanning 2016 through last year. We're talking about this on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you think schools and districts must do to root out racism? It's 800-642-1234. Darnisha Garbati is president of the Burlington Coalition for Dismantling Racism. She filed a complaint with DPI in response to the racism her two children faced as students in the Burlington schools. Darnisha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Well, give us some historical context, if you will. Tell us about what your girls experienced in Burlington schools.
Some of the things they experienced were, being called the N-word on a regular basis. Students would yell it as they would be walking through the hallways, or if they would be sitting in class, they would be saying the N-word. Jokes would be being made. For example, people are like jelly beans. Nobody likes the black ones. Mm. My youngest daughter had been spit on more than once. She had been pushed down the stairs. She had a tooth knocked out. She had been falsely accused by two different principals, one of which accused her of plotting to shoot up the school when she brought a clear and orange toy gun to school on show and tell day when she was just 9 years old. She's been falsely detained in the principal's office. And those are just some of the ways that the racism showed up. But there's many more, and not just my children, but other children of color within the district as well.
You listed so many complaints for your two daughters in this 3-year period that you ran out of room on the district's formal complaint form. Shouldn't that have been a red flag for the district that something was very wrong here?
Most definitely. I think there should have been an indication to the district long before I filed the discrimination complaint that something was really wrong. Right when, Principal Jacqueline Science at Winkler accused my daughter of bringing a BB gun to school when it was really just a toy gun, and, telling her stories of black children being murdered by police officers. in an attempt to railroad her into admitting that she was planning to shoot up the school. I think at that very moment, the school district should have been aware that something was really wrong.
You sent a lot of emails. He exchanged a lot of emails with district officials about these incidents and the climate at school. Did you, ever at any point believe you were making inroads, that you were making progress, or did you feel like you were not being heard or not being believed?
Initially, I felt very optimistic. I thought that the school district would take my complaints very seriously. And in almost all of the incidents, there was the evidence to prove what I was saying. So like, you know, when my daughter was spit on and ultimately lost a tooth, there was video footage. There was video footage of students repeatedly yelling the N-word on the school bus in the presence of my other daughter. There was video footage of most of the email complaints that I had sent. And so the fact that my pleas were ignored, the fact that I was given the runaround, I wasn't told how to file a discrimination complaint. The school just completely disregarded what I was saying and showed no empathy or any concern at all for what my children was going through. I knew right away what was going on.
How did your girls describe these incidents to you? What were those conversations like, if you would be willing to share?
Absolutely. Most of the time, I didn't find out about these incidents until my children came home from school. The school district never contacted me. Even when my youngest daughter was detained in their office, essentially all day, missing valuable class time, being, mistreated, being put under a cloud of suspicion when they, in fact, were the victims of the racism, while the students who were perpetuating this racism were immediately sent back to class, were not interrogated or anything. And so I often didn't find out about these things till my children came home, even with my daughter getting her tooth knocked out. She was sitting in that office with her mouth bleeding. Nobody rendered her aid or sent her to the nurse's office. They allowed her to finish out the school day. And I didn't find out about it until she got off the school bus later that day, running home crying.
What is the racial breakdown of students in the Burlington Area School District? What is the makeup?
So Burlington as a whole, according to the last census, is 97% white, less than 0.5% Black, and then a little over 2% of people of color grouped all together. And so when you talk about the school district, the last time I checked, which was earlier this year or last year, there was only 39 Black students in the entire school district. So we're talking, about it being almost a monoethnic school district. I know that the school district recently released a statement saying that one out of every five students are students of color, but I believe that's a lie. So having 39 Black students out of 2,505 white students, those stats are not accurate.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Darnisha Garbati, who's president of the Burlington Coalition for Dismantling Racism. We're talking about her complaints and ultimately filing a complaint with DPI in response to the racism her two children faced as students in Burlington schools over a 3-year period. Those incidents reported. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Darnisha, the DPI report found suspension rates for students of color were 25 times higher than for white students. What do you make of that statistic and what your observed experience was with the discipline practices in the schools?
Those statistics are appalling. In the same token, I am not surprised by them. What we see playing out there in Burlington with discipline disparities is something that we see across Wisconsin as a whole and even beyond. Students of color are often disciplined more harshly, which is why the school to prison pipeline is such an issue. With the school district failing to hold white students accountable for the things that they were doing. You know, some of them were even criminal that they were doing to my children. And yet they didn't even receive, you know, any discipline at all. But then there were times where my daughter was like sitting sideways on the school bus and the bus driver threatened to give her a ticket. And then the school principal, Mr. Schimmel, called me and I told him, I said, were all the white students sitting sideways on the school bus? I said, and if they were, they all need to get a ticket too. And I told him to pull up the video footage. He then changed his mind about giving my daughter a ticket because he didn't want to send home tickets with all the white students. And so, you know, these things are happening all over. It's not just the Burlington Area School District. Our children are being disciplined more harshly and white students aren't being held accountable for what they're doing.
Let's bring in a call now. Jacob is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Jacob. What is your experience?
Hi. Yes, I think Darnisha just made the point I mentioned to your call taker that Burlington is a poster child for majority white communities all over the state and majority white school districts all over the state. This is not a unique situation in Burlington. It's just the fact that this is being exposed. I believe this is the underbelly of white racism in our country, and it's being exposed here, but it is no different than school districts across the state and across the country and communities, particularly white majority communities across the state and the country.
Jacob, thank you for that. Darnisha, you know, you're looking at this as well as a much, much larger statewide problem as well.
Absolutely. I have talked to multiple friends, as well as other families whom I have become friends with. And sadly enough, because we've been comparing stories of racism that's playing out in our school districts amongst our Black and brown children. This is definitely a common, very, very, very common narrative, you know. That's why so many racial justice organizations exist these days. You know, there's definitely a need for them because of what's happening with our children, you know, from Shorewood to Greendale to Waukesha to Burlington and beyond, you know, and even in Milwaukee, with Milwaukee public schools being predominantly made up of students of color, there's quite a bit of racism playing out there as well. You know, most of the teachers and administrators are white. And that's the problem. That's a part of the problem. A part of the problem is that you see a lack of representation of Black and brown teachers. In the Burlington Area School District, there's only one Black teacher in the entire school district. And you see a lack of Black and brown leaders within the schools. So those are just two of the issues that's contributing to the racism that we see playing out on a day-to-day basis.
Let's look more closely at the DPI, the Department of Public Instruction report that came out last week, coming to the conclusion that these complaints are very valid and that the district had created a racially hostile environment. What is your response to the DPI findings?
Overall, I am, you know, really happy about DPI's decision. I'm also saddened by it. I'm sad that it had to come to this. I'm sad that it had to take this long. I'm sad that I had to file so many appeals to get to this point. In the same token, I'm glad that DPI is holding the Burlington Area School District accountable, because I think in doing so, it also opens up the door for other school districts to be held accountable. I'm glad that DPI is mandating the school district to come up with a plan within the next 30 days to address this racially hostile learning environment. And I'm hoping that this will put all Wisconsin schools and beyond on notice, that racism will not be tolerated, whether it be from students, staff, administrators, or even board members.
We're talking with Darnisha Garbati, who founded the Burlington Coalition for Dismantling Racism. She's been working to address the racial issues and inequities in the schools there for over a year. Are you the parent of a child of color who's experienced racism at school? Did you report it? What was the outcome? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Darnisha Garbati here on the Ideas Network.
The following segment contains language that some may find offensive.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about how to dismantle systemic racism in schools and the actions taken by the Department of Public Instruction to remedy a racially hostile climate in Burlington schools. Darnisha Garbati has been working for years to be heard following the experiences her two kids had and to be a voice for other parents. She's president of the group Burlington Coalition for Dismantling Racism, and she's with us for 10 more minutes. Darnisha, last year, Burlington School Board, the district school board, late last year adopted an anti-harassment, anti-racism policy. Did this step do anything to get at these underlying problems, these issues?
No, it didn't. Actually, it made it worse because what happened is when they adopted the anti-racism policy, they only adopted about 8 sentences of the policy. And let's back up a little bit. So the policy that they ended up adopting, our coalition, the Burlington Coalition for Dismantling Racism, put together a sample anti-racism policy that other school districts were using. And we kind of combined them and put them together, submitted it to the school district for review. They were telling us all along that they would allow us to have a voice and be included in the adoption of an anti-racism, an anti-bullying and anti-harassment policy. When the time came to vote on the policy, the school district actually proceeded without us, never informing us that was the plan. And then they only included 8 sentences of the actual anti-racism policy. And of those 8 sentences, 5 of them were just definitions of racially conscious words. So there was actually only about 3 sentences of the policy included. With that being said, the district essentially just checked off a box just to be able to say that they adopted an anti-racism policy so that they can post it on their website under equity. And even in the DPI complaint, they, you know, mentioned, oh, we adopted an anti-racism policy. And so I think it did more damage than good.
So it sounds like the real work at this really difficult issue, the real work wasn't being done.
Not at all. And you can see that being evidenced throughout DPI's ruling. There's 33 pages. And, you know, you see where the district is saying, OK, we adopted an anti-racism policy. Check. We brought in the National Equity Project. Check. And I think what happened is when the district took on the idea of just doing things just to be able to say that they did things, I think that all it did was covered up what was happening, swept it under the rug, and put them in a position to not actually have to deal with anything. But as we can see, their efforts didn't go very far at all in DPI's ruling of this being a racially hostile learning environment. They started their partnership with the National Equity Project last year. And even since then, people have shown up in virtual classrooms, repeatedly calling students the N-word, you know, and I have video footage of that. And, you know, a student of color was called the N-word by a Burlington High School football player during a game. The words "die, nigger, die" has been spray painted in the middle school on the floor. The words "no niggers" has been etched into.
And we do not want to say that word on the air, so please try to do your best not to say that. I want to, Darnisha, ask you, you know, going forward for Burlington schools, what do you want to see happen here? You know, what could change and make the climate change as well and not be, as I think what I'm hearing from you, window dressing?
Absolutely. And, you know, I apologize for my use of the actual N-word. In the same token, the fact that I can't even say that on air, but children are being called this word every single day, every day. It just further drives home why this is so wrong. And to answer the question you just asked me, I think what the Burlington Area School District and, you know, all school districts can do is diversify the staff, diversify the leadership. We want to see them adopt anti-racism policies and curriculum. We want to see them address the discipline disparities. We want to essentially see them do what they're already doing with white students. What we're asking is to do the same thing for children of color. We're asking them to provide a safe environment. We're asking them to hold people accountable who perpetuate racism, who participate in it, who remain silent in the face of it. We're asking them, instead of overly disciplining Black and brown children, we're asking them to have verbal conversations with them as they do white students, redirect them, teach them another way, get them counseling services, stop sending them to school police officer liaisons. We're asking them to do things that they're already doing. Let quite a bit of the staff be people of color, like you already currently have staff being white people. Let the administrators be representative of Black and brown bodies. These things aren't hard. We just want for our children the same opportunities that white children are getting. All students should have rights to these things. It's a human rights issue.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Darnisha Garbati, who's president of the Burlington Coalition for Dismantling Racism. And we're talking about the issue in Burlington, but the much broader issue of how to go about dismantling racism. And your response, 800-642-1234. Jack is joining us from Caledonia. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think a big point from the racism thing that is missing is clear ignorance. If you're judging anybody or calling people by their ethnic heritage, it's a sign of ignorance. It's nothing more than that. Okay, and I wish parents would start teaching their kids how to respect others in all aspects of life. And it's just irritating that ignorance is so blissing around in some families. That's all my comment.
Darnisha, can you address that? Is there ignorance here that is underlying this?
I think that in some of the instances, it's definitely ignorance in the fact that it's willful ignorance. I also think that a lot of this racism is blatant, bold, and intentional. I don't think that, you know, it's accidental in almost most of these situations. I think that silence and complacency contributes to it happening even more. I think it thrives and breeds from the lack of addressing it immediately, denouncing it, and making it clear that it won't be tolerated and is not welcome. I think that some of it, you know, stems from unconscious bias and, you know, stereotypes and microaggressions. But I think that there's a hybrid of it. And I think what it's going to take is some inner work, you know, taking a look at ourselves, taking a look at like the superintendent. I've encouraged him and challenged him to start by checking his own bias. You know, I think the school district as a whole should do a climate survey.
Darnisha, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. And thank you for having me here today.
Darnisha Garbati, president of the Burlington Coalition for Dismantling Racism. We're currently setting up a time to talk with Burlington Superintendent Stephen Plank in the coming days. The district released a 2-page statement to the media 1 week ago. The last sentence, it reads, "It has been uncomfortable to realize that even as we try to do our best every day for every student, we need to do better." Just ahead, we talk with two clean water activists about efforts underway to protect water supplies. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.